SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough! Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We are back at Monmouth Park, now just 20 minutes away from the kickoff to sports wagering, and the parlor itself now filling up, as well as people milling outside in the grandstand. And, of course, one of the nice features here, the banners of all the owners of horses that won the Haskell. And the one maybe most poignant that is right, one of the first that you see adjacent to the William Hill parlor, that of James Scaturcio, and of course Scat Daddy. And the first thing that caught my eye when I walked in today, with Justify, who now is being very aggressively courted, I can tell you, by Monmouth. They will make every effort to get Justify here, as they did American Pharoah. A little more on that when we get a chance to talk to John Himes, the racing secretary now, and, of course, the longtime communications chief here as well. Turning our attention back to Hong Kong and the season in its end run, but there's some exciting things, and in fact a lot of attention being given to the jockey race there, and two of the world's most notable riders, and picking up where Pat Cummings left off, Andrew Hawkins. And a pleasure to welcome him back. Andrew, I appreciate you picking up Pat's mantle.
Yeah, it's great to be back with you, Steve. Obviously, big shoes to fill with Pat, no longer with the Jockey Club, but he's taking on a great new role back in the States, and I look forward to seeing what he does. He's a great operator. I think Craig and the board have got a very good executive director there, so exciting to see what Pat does. But yes, the racing still goes on here in Hong Kong.
Not only does it go on, you may get the opportunity to utilize some of your opinions as well, for those that haven't paid attention. DRF, Andrew's analysis has been available for players. We'll talk about some maybe some ideas for the weekend, but let's get a little bit of the landscape as we look toward the last few meets of the season, Andrew, and set the stage.
Yeah, very interesting last few race meetings, last few days ahead of our season closing. Our season comes to an end in mid-July, so we're about a month out now. We've got 8 days left. I think I saw the figure yesterday, it's about 75 races left in the season. And for us, a big factor is going to be who wins our jockey championship, who will be named our champion jockey. For us here in Hong Kong, that's a prestigious title. We actually haven't had that many champion jockeys since we moved into the modern era in the mid-70s, because we had a number of jockeys along the way win multiple championships. We had the reign of Basil Marcus through the 1990s, the South African jockey Basil Marcus, who was then followed by Douglas White, the most successful jockey we've ever had in Hong Kong with 13 wins. And picking up from where Douglas is still riding in Hong Kong, and picking up from him was Joe Moreira, the Brazilian magic man who has won the last three championships and look like being a mainstay of the jockey roster in Hong Kong. However, he announced last week that he was going to be packing up his saddle and moving across to Japan, chasing an in into that very closed-off environment in Japan. There are only two foreign riders in Japan, in Mirko De Muro and Christophe Lemaire. So you have to be able to fulfill quite a few difficult language tests to be able to get a JRA license full-time. But Joe Norreira is going to try and do that from next season. So these last 8 meetings are the last chances to see Joe Norreira in action in Hong Kong. But this time, he's facing a major championship battle. He's won the last three championships very easily. But this time, he's facing a major obstacle in Zach Purton. Zach is a one-time champion in Hong Kong, but Zach has currently taken the lead in the last couple of days. He's now established a 5-win lead over Joe Morera, and given the number of races we have in Hong Kong, that's quite a sizable advantage. Look, it's difficult to make up that sort of ground as quickly as Zach has done. So that's basically the crux of it. At the moment, a lot of horses in the Hong Kong horse population are being put away looking towards next season, or they're trying to get their handicap mark down. So in terms of chances in races, there aren't that many, and most of them are going to either Zach or Joe. So if you are watching Hong Kong in the next 4 or 5 weeks, always be having a look at what Zach Purton is riding, what Joe Morera is riding, and you'll pretty much have a great clue as to who are the likely market leaders in these races, Steve.
Talk about the decision with Morero, Andrew, because I saw the story in the South China Morning Post, and people seem surprised, even though Morero said that he didn't even expect to stay as long as he has. It still seems to have taken people a little bit by surprise, and you know, the success that he had, and I suppose, you know, the money. I mean, is the money in Japan different? I mean, is it something that he's doing for his own career, you know, just for experiences, or because it seems like how much better could he do in Japan than he's done and does in Hong Kong?
Yeah, good point. Japan is a very different environment to Hong Kong. In terms of Japan, it is such a part of the fabric of Japanese sport. There's not a lot going on otherwise. You've got sumo wrestling, you've got baseball, but racing's such a mainstream sport in Japan that I think he wanted to see how that is. Now, granted, in Hong Kong, it is still a very big deal, but Japan, unlike anywhere else in the world, receives this mainstream attention, and I think that for him, he has always been allured by Japan. When he was riding with great success in Singapore before he moved to Hong Kong, he tried to get into Japan. He'd fallen in love with Japan and wanted to head there, but he was not seen as having done enough to warrant a license at that point. So he looked elsewhere. There were two opportunities for him. He was either going to move to Hong Kong or he was going to move to the United States. He'd actually done some riding for Wesley Ward. I think he rode Judy the Beauty at Churchill a couple of times, just on fly-in, fly-out missions from Singapore, and there was an offer there to go to the United States. But he came to Hong Kong in the end, and so he's been incredibly successful. I think for him, he just wants another challenge. He doesn't see himself as being a career rider. I think he sees himself, he's 34 now, I think he wants to retire by the time he's 40. I think for him, he has earned a lot of money in Hong Kong. Purses in Japan are big, but he probably won't earn as much as he has in Hong Kong with the dominance that he had. Still, financially, he's well off from his Hong Kong experiences, and I think for him, it's just about achieving a personal goal. He has been a jockey that has moved around from place to place, obviously within Brazil firstly, then to Singapore, then to Hong Kong. I think for him, it's just the allure of the challenge. But it is probably one of the biggest stories I've seen since I've been in Hong Kong. I've been in Hong Kong 5 years now, and I arrived the same week as Joe Morera, in fact, in Hong Kong. And to see him leave, I think it was expected that he would leave at some point, but I think most felt he had another year or two left in him in Hong Kong. So definitely changes the landscape here in Hong Kong.
On that front, based on what Tom Biddington had to say in the SCMP, Zach Burton obviously now stands alone. I mean, and sits atop that, you know, that colony, and simultaneously, the bettors in general, there's going to be a vacuum here. I suppose the money that Marrero drew, which was ridiculous in a lot of cases, particularly when Hong Kong Jockey Club runs their all dirt cards, and everybody was betting Marrero, even though he wasn't nearly as good on the dirt as on the grass. But this should really affect the betting patterns, won't it, Andrew?
You think it will definitely affect the betting patterns. As you say, Hong Kong is a very interesting betting environment because you have two extremes. You have these computer teams, these very shrewd database gamblers who are capitalizing on the fact that there is also a very large, uninformed or less informed public. There's this stream of money that comes in into our markets that you have no idea why certain things are starting short, and usually it is. It'll be random things like they've the jockey's had a birthday or has had a child or has had a wedding. It's a time for luck, and so there are people being able to siphon that money. Now, with Joe, it happened a lot more often because strike rate was so high that when there were times, for instance, where he hadn't won the winner in the first seven races on a meeting, and the eighth, everyone was parlaying into it. Everyone was saying, okay, well, he's due a winner. He's going to have to bet purely, you know, he could be riding a horse that should have been 20 to 1, 30 to 1, and go 2 to 1, 3 to 1 just because of that factor. So you're right. There's going to be money that was blindly going on to Marrero and now going elsewhere, and I think you'll probably see it. You're already starting to see the extent with Zach's bounce starting shorter, but it does also create a more open market. And I think you might actually start to see, especially early next season in Hong Kong, September, October, November, you see some odd betting patterns, some odd moves, which would be inexplicable to anyone who's outside of Hong Kong, but it'll be something linked to luck or feng shui as I say, a birthday or something that really should not be having any impact on a market because it really doesn't change a horse's winning chance, you know.
Well, Andrew Hawkins with us and talking about the big news from the past week. I get maybe, I don't know what's the bigger news, Pat Cummings leaving or Joe Marrero, but they affect both hemispheres and opposite sides of the globe equally, undoubtedly. The Happy Valley action, Andrew, and then looking forward to Sha Tin this weekend?
Yeah, at Happy Valley the other night, we had potentially a horse that's going to be one of our top sprinters next season winning, a horse called Hot King Prawn.
Right.
I know Pat was a big fan of Hot King Prawn, and I know that Hot King Prawn's actually got quite a few American followers. I was talking to one earlier who was very excited seeing that he'd won, but he's a horse that he's a great three-year-old who looks like he's heading towards our big sprint. He'll probably be in the Hong Kong sprint in December. So he made his Happy Valley debut and was able to win pretty comfortably with Zach Purton aboard. Zach rode four winners at Happy Valley to extend his jockey's title lead. So interesting night at Happy Valley. But obviously, as you say, we look to the weekend's action and interesting little card coming up at Sha Tin. We race Friday night your time, not Saturday night this week, but again, it's the jockey battle between Joe Marrero and Zach Purton that takes center stage here.
A couple of highlights.
Yeah, a couple of highlights here. I'm interested to see what a horse called He's the One for Us does with Joe Marrera aboard. Again, a three-year-old heading some of our better races. So he comes up in our eighth race, which is a Class 2. A three-year-old that we think might be heading towards Classic Miles, those sorts of races, which come up January, February, our four-year-old Classic Series. So he's lightly raced in New Zealand in Port. He should be interested in that. What happens in there, he takes to the horse called Gilbert Lucky, who did actually run in the Classic Series this year, ran behind Nothing I Like More and Singapore Sling, some very good form there. So they're definitely highlights there. The other highlight that I'd keep a close eye on comes up in the ninth race at Sha Tin, a horse called Glorious Forever. He's a full brother to our Hong Kong Cup winner, Hong Kong Gold Cup winner as well in Time Warp. Had his second start last time out. He was ridden by Tommy Berry. Tommy Berry just let him roll on the lead like Time Warp has been known to do. And he almost stole the race from the front. It took Consort, once upon a time, a Royal Ascot pace getter in the St. James's Palace Stakes. It took Consort running him down for him to get beaten. But Zach Purton, who's Time Warp's regular rider, jumps aboard for the first time. He's very interesting to watch in this spot. So that's the ninth race at Sha Tin. Keep an eye on Glorious Forever, who will probably lead out by a considerable margin mid-race.
Well, happy that Andrew Hawkins will continue the conversations from the Hong Kong Jockey Club. And, of course, we can also utilize Andrew's expertise and appreciation for everything back home in Australia. We're going to pick up those options as well, Andrew, when they avail themselves and appreciate it. And we'll talk next week.
Cheers, Steve. Talk next week.
Andrew Hawkins, who you can follow on Twitter, Andrew NJ Hawkins, and the time that Andrew puts in for the Hong Kong work and his analysis, the selections that you can find at DRF, which a little bonus as well, and not just Andrew's, but you've got a nice variety of opinions being offered. And then Marcus Hirsch, too. Marcus writing plenty about what goes on in Hong Kong. He keeps an eye. So lots of coverage at DRF and with Andrew Hawkins. Let's take a break. 90 minutes in. 90 to come. Steve Haskin and his piece that I encourage you to read, his recap among the things he's already written since Saturday. And he and Joan were on hand. And then they were on hand at King of Birdos, too. But Steve wrote a really different kind of recap that included his trip to Kentucky, which was really nice. He had spent time, of course, you know, we talked to him from Kentucky, and then he also recapped it as well. But the time he spent at Windstar, and he used that opportunity to a little bit of a behind the curtain and to appreciate, you know, the personality, the real people that are behind what feels like a corporate image and a kind of a conglomeration in terms of the Stallion Farms and the breeding operations. Steve really takes that away and connects you to the people that really are Windstar, you know, aside from, you know, the gloss. And I thought that was really nice. So we'll let Steve talk to that and his pleasure and experience at witnessing another Triple Crown win. Second half at the races. We're live at Monmouth. They're just starting the ceremony behind me to place the first wager. Governor Murphy is going to get down. And then everybody else can start to pick their poison. Back after this at the races.
The latest racing news. It's At The Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Do you want unlimited access to handicapping without exorbitant prices? Then BridgeNet.com has you covered with a variety of plans for past performances, pedigree, and raw data. The BridgeNet.com Performance Plan offers unlimited PDF past performances for just $75 per month and is available at BridgeNet.com/PP. American Produce Records Online puts the pedigrees of nearly 1 million dams and more than 2 million foals at your fingertips, plus sire stats, for only $275 per year and is available at BridgeNet.com/APR. The BridgeNet.com data plan offers unlimited access to race day data files, perfect for handicappers with their own database or to plug into other people's programs. The data plan is just $125 per month. Visit BridgeNet.com for all this information and more, and discover why BridgeNet.com is the handicapper's edge.
Hi, this is retired race caller Tom Durkin. So, after this year's Derby, I stopped by Top Round Roast Beef on Shelbyville Road in St. Matthews. I got two sandwiches, one for back at the hotel and another for the trip back home to New York. The first one was so good, I had the other one right there. Certified Angus beef, roasted 5 hours, each one made to order. You can taste the difference. Top Round Roast Beef, Shelbyville Road, St. Matthews. Tell them Tom Durkin sent you. Oh, by the way, try the frozen custard too.
This is Steve Cole from the Cole Ranch, a horse farm and training center located in California. We offer folks the chance to join hands with us to own a young racehorse from our farm. We're dramatically different compared to most popular racing partnerships because we don't charge fees or commissions, and we don't inflate the value of the horse. Most racing partnerships buy a horse at auction for, say, $100,000, then turn around and sell shares for $200,000. We value our horses realistically and don't add on fees or commissions. Right now, Cole Ranch is selling shares in a 2-year-old calibred colt named Mr. Wickham. He's by Heatseeker out of Serena's Echo, our stakes-producing mare, who is a full sister to multimillionaire Thor's Echo. You can get into this horse for as little as $1,000, which will entitle you to a 5% interest. If you want to invest in this horse, please call me at area code 805-990-3669 or visit us on the web at thecoleranch.com.
Ooh, nah, nah, yeah. Don't act like you know me, nah, nah, yeah.
Now, back to At The Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
What you gonna do?
Yeah, time is money, so don't fuck my mind. Seeing out with my girls, I'ma have a good time. Step back with your chit-chat, killing my vibe.
We are back at the races, back at Monmouth Park, not far from Steve Haskin, and certainly, Steve, as I look over at a Max's hot dog stand, Steve can appreciate, and he'll certainly get his chance maybe this summer to come up for Haskell, or for some occasion, right, Steve? You get up here to Monmouth, maybe to get a nice sports bet in now?
It's possible I might check it out one of these days. You mentioned Max's. I'm probably the only person that likes Max's for their veggie burgers.
Well, you got no choice if you're gonna keep to it. Although, as Lenny said the other day,
did you know that Mrs. Max? You notice if you go there, you know they also sell corn on the cob. And she's the one that convinced Nathan, the owner of Nathan's, to sell corn on the cob, which became one of their big sellers because, you know, it was very difficult getting corn on the cob anywhere outside of your house. And people used to go to Nathan's, and besides the hot dogs and all the other great stuff they had there, they had a special section for corn on the cob. And it was Mrs. Max who said, "Why don't you sell corn on the cob?"
How about that?
A little bit of Mrs. Max history for you.
I love it. well, I may swing through. I'm heading back today. I had hoped to go. I didn't didn't let this, I kind of hinted at it, but I didn't give the specifics. I was hoping to go from here to Churchill to do the weekend preview tomorrow from Churchill and then be on hand for Saturday night. And I was there for the American Pharoah ceremony, and it was so much fun. It was just a deliriously different from, you know, Derby trips and Breeders' Cup trips, you know, being in Louisville and having a, just a casual Saturday, you know, after broadcasting. But, and Tina came in. But it's Father's Day on Sunday. So I couldn't get back. I tried everything. I tried from Newark. I tried from Baltimore if I had to, flying direct to Hartford. I tried everything I could, but I couldn't get out Sunday to be able to get home to Manchester to see my father. I mean, we've got a luncheon. It's also his birthday. It's his 89th birthday. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I'm not going to get to go to no Churchill this weekend. But let's.
Well, wish him a happy Father's Day. Did you try Cincinnati?
You know what? Now that you say that, I didn't. I mostly was trying to put through Louisville and. You know, Albany and all different. I mean, but I'm here. I mean, I could have driven back. I've tried all every combo. It's too late now, but that is a good point. The Cincinnati angle would have been worth at least.
Because that's what we did. We flew from Philly to Cincinnati because it was on Delta. It was $194 round trip.
Yes.
United. The flight I always used to take, the nonstop from Newark to Lexington, was a mere $1,138.
Nice.
What are you kidding? Why don't you just say, I don't want anybody on this plane?
That's pretty funny.
You know, it's like United should say, well, here's our price. If you fly it, you're the biggest sucker in the world.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, you know, wow. I mean, good grief. These airlines.
No, it's hard. It's
so actually worked out fine. I mean, I hadn't been in the Cincinnati airport in ages, and I didn't realize by the way, it takes about a half an hour to walk through the terminal to get out. You got to get they have a train, you know, when these
trains
run there, but. But no, it's a nice airport. It was very convenient. It's not that bad a drive from Cincinnati.
No, it's not. It's an easy trip actually, I'm sorry, it didn't occur to me to make that angle. Anyway,
and you passed my favorite exit on 75 going to Lexington. My favorite exit for Big Bone Lick Park.
There you go. Steve, let's get to Saturday, and was able to actually get a little bit of recapping in with you in person on Saturday night at King Umberto's, but you've seen your share of Triple Crown frustration, and now in close proximity, a pair of Triple Crown successes.
Yes, this was the 21st horse I've seen try for the Triple Crown after winning the Derby and the Preakness. So I've seen a little bit of everything, starting with the controversial attempt by Forward Pass in 1968, all the way through this rest of the 60s, with Majestic Prince in 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s. So I've seen it. I've seen it all, and I got to say this, you know, the way history is so cyclical, where you had the big 25-year gap between Citation and Secretariat, where everybody said, oh, this is never going to be done. You know, we went through the 60s and Damascus couldn't do it. And like I said, Majestic Prince couldn't do it. Northern Dancer couldn't do it. We just had, after a while, you just said, you know, we don't know if anybody's going to do it. And we thought Canyonero was going to do it. And Weaver Ridge caught a sloppy track in 72 and wasn't able to, you know, handle it after winning the Derby and then winning the Belmont easily both times. So, and then of course Secretary does it, and then boom, boom, boom. You know, you start getting you get three, three in a row, and then by the time Spectacular Bit tried for it, everybody thought, oh well, this is going to be another breeze, and nobody knew that when Spectacular Bit failed, we were going to go 37 years, and now all of a sudden we've got two of them in 4 years. So I don't have to tell you how exciting American Pharoah was. I mean, that was special. I've never seen the place rock like that. But this one was very different. We had so many people in 2015 who went and just wanted to know the feeling of what it's like. I mean, so many of the younger generation, I mean, just people in their early 40s were not around. They had no idea what a Triple Crown winner was. I mean, they were 3-4 years old when the firm won the Triple Crown. So they come, and everybody just wanted, they thought for sure they were going to see it with Smarty Jones, and they thought for sure they were going to see it with Big Brown. And I'll Have Another look like a lock before he got hurt. California Chrome, they thought for sure. I mean, it's just one disappointment after another. And then when it finally happened, it was like this revelation. And then going into this year, they knew it could happen. It was a different feeling. They weren't waiting for the Triple Crown gremlins to strike, for something to go wrong. They knew it could happen. So there was a different kind of excitement in the air. Now, granted, Justify had his detractors, including, some of the experts on TV who did not like his Preakness, because he regressed. I actually thought his Preakness was may have been his best race. When you take things all into consideration, when you have a horse that's crammed at so many races in such a short period of time, and he comes out of the Kentucky Derby running in the slop, beating a really, really good horse in Good Magic, who was a champion, and he comes out of the race with a foot bruise and basically has no serious training between the Derby and the Preakness. And then he goes and he winds up running head-to-head for over a mile with Good Magic, the horse he has to beat, and winds up winning anyway. This is after running the fastest opening fractions in the history of the Kentucky Derby by the winning horse. So I thought, forget about the buyer numbers and Thoroughgraph on there. That race, to me, transcended numbers. I thought it was his best race. It was a courageous race to be able to go head-to-head with Good Magic like that and get the best of him. So, after that, it made him a bit polarized going into the Belmont. And, a lot of people thought, I started catching up. I came back and watched the NBC telecast. And, like, Randy Moss picked against him. He picked Hofburg because he thought that he might be tailing off from the Preakness. And, listen, if anybody wants to think that, that's fine. It was logical thinking if you wanted to believe that he was tailing off. If you're a numbers guy, he does the buyer numbers, so I can understand that. But there were people that thought he was going to romp, and well, we had some, we had something in between. But for the people to have experienced it before, I mean, that place was electric. I mean, it was alive all day. They gave out the Justified crowns, and you had all the Triple Crown winning jockeys signing, and the lines were like humongous there. To have Turcotte, Espinoza, and Crouquet, and Julie Crone was there. To me another magical day, and it was different now. The mentality was different because they knew what it was like. They knew it could be done. So they had a different mindset going into the race. They could feel it. They were insatiable. Now they wanted it. They wanted to taste it in a different way. They wanted to taste it knowing it could happen, as opposed to waiting for that little shred of doubt in their mind that something was going to go wrong with American Pharoah. He looked like the best, but something always goes wrong. Well, now they know that that doesn't mean anything. So I just think it was so exciting when he won. And you got to remember, too, this is such a big, flashy chestnut. You know, it's a secretariat type. It was Majestic Prince going in. People loved these chestnuts, these gorgeous chestnuts. And here you got, and it would have been the same, you know, had Point Given gone into the Triple Crown if he had won the Derby. Because people really embraced him afterwards the rest of the year until he got hurt. But I just thought with a horse like this, with a white face and a big, powerful horse, there was something so charismatic about him. Mike Smith added to the equation. Now, everybody was rooting for Mike Smith. And what you have to just acknowledge is the fact that Bob Baffert is just... he is just amazing. I mean, it's amazing what this guy has accomplished. And you got to remember, he went through a drought after War Emblem. He went, you know, he thought Real Quiet to War Emblem was a drought. He couldn't believe when War Emblem won it that he hadn't won it in 3 years. But he didn't realize that it was going to go from 2002 to 2015 that he wasn't going to win the Derbies. And, you know, I mean, he had terrific horses, but he really never came close. So, you know, for him to come, at, you know, at this stage of his life now, to have two Triple Crown winners from 2015 and then another one 3 years later, and who knows if in between, who knows if Mastery hadn't gotten hurt, how good he could have been. And look at the, and then forgetting even about the Triple Crown horses, then to have late developers like Arrogate and West Coast, I mean, my God, the talent that this guy has had over the last few years is just amazing. But, you know, it's not like they were all extraordinarily bred horses. He turned them into great horses. You know, old school training. You cull out the ones that aren't good. You train the ones that are good hard. And that's why he was able to win the Kentucky Derby with a, you know, with a horse that had not raced at two after all those years since Apollo. And that's why he was able to win the Triple Crown with a horse with virtually no foundation. I mean, no two-year-old foundation, because he trains them hard. If they withstand his training, they're going to show that they have that foundation. They are tough. So, you know, maybe it was his old quarter horse training. I don't know. But whatever he does, it's absolutely brilliant for him to do this year after year, to come up with horses like this. And then you get the lost horses that people forget about. Poor Opportunity. Nobody even notices. His horse is 7 years old. You know, he wins the Brooklyn. He won the Jockey Club Gold Cup. All the races he won in California. He just keeps plugging along, and Baffert just kept him going for years. Look how long he kept Game On Dude going. The only horse in history to win three Santa Anita handicaps. You know, won the big three, won the Gold Cup, and won the Pacific Classic. I mean, it's just amazing what he's able to accomplish. And he's able to do it without having any grass horses. I mean, he does not believe in grass racing. I mean, he never has a grass horse. But I tell you, he knows how to develop these horses, whether he develops them from 2-1 or starting it on February 18th as a three-year-old. So I think all in all, it was just a very special day, and I think we saw a very special horse. Sure, he didn't blow him away in the Derby Preakness or Belmont. He wasn't secretariat. He didn't break any records. He didn't run any astronomical speed figures. But for him to win those three races with such a lack of foundation and do it the way he did it, too, on, you know, people forget, too, he's run six times in his life at six different distances. Seven furlongs to a mile and a half, six different distances he's done it. And he's done it on sloppy tracks, muddy tracks, and fast tracks. So at this stage of his career, I don't know of any horse that's accomplished what he's accomplished in such a short period of time. So I think it's really, really exciting. And who knows what we're going to see after Baffert is able to freshen him a little bit. He's never had a freshening, you know, in his brief career. So you freshen him up for a couple of months, and if he brings, I don't know if he'll bring him back into Haskell, or maybe just, you know, train him up to the Travers, or maybe find another prep. I don't know if he's going to try that. It's a very difficult double, winning the Travers, the Classical and the Travers, as he learned with American Pharoah. But it'll be very interesting, you know, to see if he approaches the Crabbers the way he did with a horse like Arrogate, you know, just bring him up, give him just an easy prep beforehand. But I'm really curious. This horse hasn't even matured yet. I mean, we haven't even seen it. He hasn't peaked. He's won the Triple Crown before he even peaked. This horse is going to peak. Well, he's probably going to peak when he's already at stud. That's when his peak is, when he's a four-year-old. But he's going to be a much better horse for the Travers and even a better horse for the Classic. And hopefully they keep him around for the Pegasus before they retire him. But obviously they're going to retire him. The money is just too big out there. So we'll see. What was your impression of the day all around?
It was a special day, and it was for me in a lot of ways more enjoyable. I won't say that it was, you know, better than American Pharoah's win and what went on that day, but I can tell you that the anticipation and the uncertainty factor was much less, at least for me, Steve. And I don't know if I took some of that momentum from Hammer and his confidence, or, you know, and Baffert and his and everybody that was so confident. But I expected him to win. I think I probably would have been more disappointed had he gotten beat than I would have been had American Pharoah gotten beat. But I was looking forward to it, and then it was exactly as I kind of envisioned, to be honest. That, you know, as you and I talked, I mean, we talked right after Preakness, and you know, you wrote hours after Preakness about the potential in terms of how physically he fit a profile that has been notoriously successful at Belmont with the opportunity. And that is a big horse on the big sweeping turns and just galloping everybody into submission. And
with a big stride, too.
Yeah.
With a stride like it.
Yeah.
The stride is what... Because listen, we saw Vino Rosso emerge from the pack and pull like to within a half a length of him, and you start saying, it's Vino Rosso,
no,
and across his breadth for
no.
a mile and a half.
Nope.
Nope. He's looking strong, and then Mike Smith just let out a notch, and then that was the end.
They were being ridden, Steve. That's the difference. Everybody else was being ridden through that turn, and Smith had not asked at all. There was never, and even when Gronkowski, you know, made a steady advance, it was obvious that nobody was getting to him, and he may be the type that doesn't, you know, isn't necessarily going to draw off and win the way Point Given won his Belmont, but it's maybe deceptive, and it's probably one of the reasons, as you were just referencing, I think it's one of the reasons. And I wrote this on Saturday night. It's going to take a long time to understand and to appreciate what this horse accomplished, and maybe how good he is. And
it shouldn't take a long time. It shouldn't.
Well, but yet there's plenty of people who, I mean, the best comment I've heard so far, I think it was either on, whether it was on my message board or at Jerry Brown's at Thoroughgraph, how they can't wait to bet against him next time. Go ahead, just keep betting against him next time. Because
he's showing he can get better.
It's just,
you know, another thing too,
ridiculous.
By the way, I think, you know what boosted the race even more, and people might not think so, I think what boosted the race even more was Gronkowski finishing second, because these European horses, they're geared for stamina. I've seen enough Belmonts. I saw Go and Go come here and romp by eight lengths. I saw My Memoirs almost beat AP Indy. My Memoirs was a horse nobody even knew who he was. He was bought by Team Valor. He came here, was a big, big long shot, and he wound up getting beat like three quarters of a length. by AP Indy. I mean, he made him run coming stretch. He was flying at the end of that race. I remember Sunday Silence was all out to finish second over Le Voyageur, Patrick Bianco's horse coming from Europe. All the European horses that have come here for the Belmont Stakes, they've run big races. So when you see a horse ship over from Europe, you have to give him a lot of respect. And I think when you see a horse like Gronkowski run the race he did by coming from far back, to me it showed that the way the race was run, it was set up for a horse to come from out of it, a stayer. And I think it turned into a stayer's race. So, you know, if Justify had won and the first three horses throughout the race finished 1, 2, 3, you say, all right, well, the race was favoring speed and he went to the front. But for the fact that a European stayer like Gronkowski was able to come from last, far back last, it was a huge gap between the next to the last horse and him. And he made that big, ideal rail move at Belmont. You skim the rail like that and make that move, and that's the place to be, is to make that big rail move. I've seen so many horses make it, and they just do things that you don't think they're capable of doing. We saw that a few years ago in the Jockey Club Gold Cup with Ron the Greek, who was never a horse that was going to blow you away. He skimmed the rail and made that big move late and wound up running or winning off by what, 7-8 lengths or something. It was like, it was crazy. So that's the kind of move you want to make. So by Gronkowski finishing second, it showed that the track actually was favoring horses coming from out of it, you know, at least in this race, going a mile and a half, and the fact that it was favoring a horse from Europe, you know, who was trained for stamina. And, you know, when they train for stamina, they're a lot better at stamina than we are. So I was very impressed. I was very impressed the fact that he won. I don't care how he won. The fact that he was able to win the Triple Crown and making his debut February 18th. And in my last column, I made a list of all the other Triple Crown winners. How many days after their career debut did they win the Belmont Stakes? The average was just under 11 months. And this horse did it in, 14 weeks, 111 days. Unheard of. It's never been done before.
No. You also, and I want to get this in, Steve, and I urge people, I don't know if you heard, we're listening right before you joined us, but I want people to go visit Bloodhorse and read the piece, because you incorporated your trip to Kentucky and the time you spent in and around the staff at Windstar, and I thought it was nice because it kind of
trying to humanize it, you know.
Behind the veneer, exactly.
The corporate image, Windstar. All I know from Windstar, you know, they barely see Kenny Trout. He's just a name, and it's all, you know, Elliot Walden. And, you know, it's, they got 8,000 stallions, and they got horses everywhere, wherever you look, and they got a piece of this horse and a piece of that horse, and just a corporate image. And, you know, I wanted to humanize the farm and showed the people behind the scenes, you know, no matter what kind of job they have, you know, whether it's in marketing or assistant trainer or accounting, but the camaraderie and the passion that they have, and the family atmosphere that they have there. And it was, you know, it was great to see, and it was great talking to all these people and listening to the stories they had to tell and hearing about Justify, you know, when he was training up that half-mile straightaway, uphill straightaway, and how everybody was shocked what they saw, you know. And so this is going way back, you know. And then, you know, on the Derby story, I told the whole story through the eyes of Tanya and John Gunther. So hopefully I was able to just give a good background all in all of the horse. But yeah, I just thought that was, when I went to Kentucky, I just thought, look, this is going to be, and this is going to be an angle I really want to pursue. And everybody at the farm was so nice, and it was just great talking to them.
Now, it's a nice effect, and it also, again, goes to that point that we've brought up any number of times about how many people have their hands on a horse along the way, and that's a big part of really one of the undertold elements. You know, we focus on race day and we focus on the results a little too much, and everything that went into it. You know, one thing that this focus does, for instance, there's been, you know, a really nice number of pieces and attention given to Humberto Gomez, the exercise rider, and he's certainly been on a lot of prominent horses the last several years, and of course,
I got to know him really well. I was hanging around the barn because I was really smitten, you know, with Firing Line, who ironically, you know, was the horse that really made American Pharoah a run in the Kentucky Derby, who could have been any kind, you know, if he didn't really get hurt in the Preakness and never ran again. But I got to know Humberto really well. I used to hang out at the barn and we'd talk about a million things. And I didn't realize at the time when I went to visit Justify at the barn when I was in Kentucky, when we drove to Louisville, I didn't realize that that was it was exercise ride until he came over to me. He came out and started talking about those days. And I said, oh, my God. I said, I didn't realize it was you. You know, it's just funny how things work out. But he's a terrific guy, and those are the kind of people that, like you said, they're part of the backbone and, you know, make the engine go. And as Bob Baffert always says, you know, if there was a Hall of Fame for assistant trainers, Jimmy Barnes would be the first one in there. I mean, you want to talk about somebody who's handled, and I mean close. You know, you talk about Bob Baffert, but the one who's really close to all these horses, all these great horses, has been Jimmy Barnes for years and years. You know, and I go back with Baffert to the early days when Owen Hardy was his main assistant. But, you know, Jimmy and Dana, who's been with him for so many years. I mean, Dana was on Silver Charm.
Sure, point given.
It's just amazing how long they've been with Bob and the amount of incredible horses that they not only worked with but been close to. Look, Jimmy, how many times he traveled to Dubai, and he travels to the Breeders' Cup, and it's all Jimmy. You know, Bob was able to go back to California and leave his big horses with Jimmy at Churchill Downs, you know, during the Triple Crown and even leading up to the Derby. And then Jimmy suffered that catastrophic accident, and it's just, you know, it's amazing how he could have lost a leg, but it's amazing how he's recovered and he's back in action again. And you know, he's just he's perfect for Bob. You know, he's quiet, he's unassuming, he doesn't look for any big publicity, and he's one assistant trainer, by the way. There's no point of going out on your own. You can't give up horses like this every single year. You're not going to get horses like this. You know, I know a lot of people want to go out and train horses and want to be on their own. You know, you look at Norm Cassie, and you know, they want to make a name for themselves. But you know, like I said, he's married. His wife Dana has been working with Bob. It's a family affair, and he's happy where he is. And I'm sure he makes great money, and he just loves being around these horses. But you know, he could be a tremendous trainer in his own right. But he's happy doing what he's doing. So. He's perfect. He's perfect for Bob, who's very fortunate to have someone like this. You know, when you have a top assistant, how many trainers keep top assistants this long? Never. They want to go out on their own.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. And it, you know, there's only, you know, certain, there's a certain harmony to, you know, to having, you know, a professional. It's a partnership, really, when it, you know, when you, I mean, the titles are incidental. I mean, it's a teamwork philosophy.
Listen, that's why Bobby. That's why Bobby Frankel paid his top assistants like, you know, $250,000 a year. Bought them house. You know, they bought houses and brand new cars. Because when he went out to California, they took his they took his assistants away, and he said, "I'm not going to let that happen anymore." So, you know, he hired Ruben and Umberto, and, you know, paid him the world, and they stuck with him all those years. And why not? They're not going to make that kind of money anywhere else.
Well, Steve, now we turn toward, you know, whatever's going to be the next, you know, the next few chapters in what has been a lightning strike of a story. You know, how many times can you think of where there's a buzz about a certain horse and debut and you hear something, and then even if they're successful, a lot of times it kind of fizzles out. This one was, you know, was a momentum builder. Not only was the debut impressive, horse got an education. A bit of an adventure. Didn't look like, you know, thought maybe early on in that race under Drayden Van Dyke, looked a little shaky, but from there it just grew into its own, just a bit of an avalanche style.
Well, you know, people forget, by the way, that Bob Baffert had three legitimate major contenders for the Derby.
Right.
He had McKenzie, who was his big horse. He thought McKenzie was going to, you know, be a major star. And he had Salamini, who was, you know, who had proven himself as already in grade one races as a two-year-old. And then he had Marino, who romped going down to Oaklawn Park, you know, whether he was going to be a Derby horse or not. He was already starting out on the Derby trail with a very impressive win at Oaklawn Park. So he had three major Derby horses, and Justify hadn't even run.
That's amazing.
When he made his debut, Baffert already had three major Derby horses. And I'll tell you something else, by the way. We'll see how he does. But I'll tell you, a horse that he is extremely through the roof over is this Axeman, who's running in the Matt Wynn on Saturday. He told me a while ago, he said, "Wait, watch this horse." He said, "This is a really, really good horse." And then he wins, he wins his last start by 8 lengths and looks fantastic. And we'll see what he does in the Matt Wynn, which is actually a pretty good race. You get some horses from the Derby trail on there. That's one great thing about this time, by the way, is that, you know, a lot of, you get over, because with New York, there's not much left. I mean, you know, they put all their big races, you know, on that one big weekend, and there's not a lot left between now and Saratoga. You know, there's a few good races. So it's nice a week later to have this, you know, huge card at Churchill Downs, to have a race like the Stephen Foster, which drew a very interesting competitive field with some pretty good horses and some possible future stars, you know, emerging. You've got World Approval coming back, and like I said, you got the Matt Wynn, you got a bunch of really good races. So it's nice to have, and like you said, you know, that they're going to honor the Derby winner, and then when they present the trophy, it's a great weekend to follow up the Triple Crown. It just keeps the energy going the longer.
Absolutely. Very much. Well, Steve, it was a lot of fun actually to be able to spend part of Saturday night afterward and the afterglow at King Umberto's too.
I'm so glad you told me. You know, I was telling Joan, I said, do you want to stop at the barn on the way back? You know, and see if they're still there. You know, we were talking about it. And then when I spoke to you afterwards, you said, they're coming to King Umberto. So I said, well, let's hang around. And it turns out they were there. So we went into the other room and I checked. They had that the balloons up and the inflatable Justify balloon there. And it was a lot of fun just talking at King Umberto and just rehashing the day, and everybody was there. You know, Umberto was there, and Jimmy and Dana were there, and it's great seeing, you know, his brother Bill again. I mean, just, you know, it was a great way to end the day. Let's put it that way.
Absolute. Well, we'll maybe see the roadshow arrive here potentially, and we know that Monmouth and Baffert have a very established relationship. So we'll see how this story, the subsequent chapters, with a plan toward Breeders' Cup Classic, and you know, trying to fill out this horse's career, and then the legacy elements, they're already being debated, no matter how things turn out going forward. But Steve, great work.
Well, you know, they compared this horse to Point Given, and you remember Point Given, you know, he might have even been the last one to win the Haskell and the Travers. You know, because from a physical standpoint, they're very similar type horses, and if you remember, Point Given was not nearly his best for the Haskell, but won anyway, and that could be what happens here. If he does want to run them both, might have learned. Yeah, he would have won both last year, to me, if American Pharoah didn't have that out-of-control two-minute lick the day before the race after traveling. You know, all the traveling that horse did back and forth all year, and the last thing he needed was to have a gallop like that the race before, and, you know, just going head-and-head, it just killed him. He wasn't ready to hold off Keen Ice after going head-and-head with Frosted. But I think what we'll say, if I can see this horse coming back if he runs him in the Haskell, again, not being quite at his best, but then really, you know, showing what he really is made of, going a mile and a quarter in the Travers. Which Baffert has had some fairly, he was always complaining about bad luck in the Travers. Well, if you look at Eric Gate in the West Coast, there's not much bad luck anymore.
No. Steve, I appreciate it. This was great, and I really, really enjoyed the recap.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Very much.
Thank
Steve
you.
Haskin, everybody. And
have a good time at Monmouth today. Hope everything works well. It should be a lot of fun out there with all the sports betting.
I just put a picture up, and I mean, the place has got, there's a big buzz, and the World Cup, the coordinated with World Cup, same time, that particular, I can see that the World Cup, that's getting a lot of conversation and attention.
Yeah, today's the first day, right? Russia
yes.
plays, I think.
And in fact, I think the first goal just got scored, actually. I see on a TV, I see somebody, it's a little too far away, but see who, what, I don't know what
yeah,
the
Russia
matchup is.
Yeah, Russia was playing what, Saudi Arabia, I think, or something like that?
Well, if that's what it is, then Russia, because it's red jersey, so it's Russia that may have scored just now.
Okay.
So,
well, look, you got opening day of the World Cup. You got opening day of the U.S. Open.
Perfect timing. Perfect timing. And in fact, there was a proposition I saw on the sheet who was going to score the first goal of World Cup. So the first ticket is cashed. We'll see.
Yeah,
Steve,
it was Alex
Ovechkin. There you go. 8-2 fast. 8-2. In fact, I think the guy actually who scored was number 8. That's funny you say that. They just had the camera on him. That's hysterical.
That's a good proposition as to what number is going to score. Forget the names. You know, what number is going to score.
That's great. And they got the open up as well. This is going to be, I have no idea how, you know, what the long-term effects are, and if it's being overestimated, underestimated, but no matter what, just seeing people on a dark day, a dark racing day, seeing the people that are here, that tells you a lot. So it really does feel like this, you know, for some outlets, for some racing organizations, this is going to be a real positive development, and Monmouth Park made
I think it has to be. I think it was something that they needed, and I think it's going to, you know, add a lot of electricity to the place, a lot of buzz.
You can hear the buzz right here through the microphone. Steve, I appreciate it. Thanks. We'll talk next week.
Right,
Steve Haskin, everybody, and another triple crown for Steve. That he's seen them all since triple crowns started to get accomplished again, starting with Secretariat. We'll take a break. I've got 45 minutes. We want to get Joe Asher from William Hill. Want to talk to him and get his insights about the American marketplace and what he expects and what you can expect as a player and more. We've got to get the Dick Powell in here, too. And tomorrow we'll have a very full weekend preview. Certainly, if you haven't seen the card yet that was drawn for Foster Night, the Foster came up tremendous. And that goes off at 8 o'clock, 7:57 Eastern. But the regret, oh, my God, $100,000, and it ended up with a 13-horse field. It's amazing how often that seems to happen. You've got a nice group in the Fleur-de-Lis, group of nine for the fillies and mares, going nine furlongs. The Wise Dan came up great. World Approval, trying to get back going. But Divisadero and Shining Copper and Mr. Misunderstood, as Brad Cox told us. And then for the the 3-year-olds, the Matt Wynn, group of seven, including Axeman, as mentioned. The Foster ended up with nine, by the way. Honorable Duty, Patch, Hot Wacom, Uncle Mojo, Matt True, Backyard Heaven, Looking at Lee, Irish War Cry, and Pavel. So nice, nice group. And actually, the time was wrong. 9:30 for the Foster. The Matt Wynn is at 7:57. Really fun day racing. We'll talk to Marty McGee and much, much more. And, of course, the festivities will include a Justify parade and Baffert and Smith and the ownership team getting their Derby trophies. Back after this to Monmouth Park. Sports betting era has begun.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Enjoy Daily Racing Form's best value with a multi-track PP pack. Get five full-card PPs featuring the day's best racing for only $6. Each DRF multi-track PP pack features full-card DRF pass performances for the top tracks you want to play. Handicapping articles and analysis, closer looks for key tracks, and selections by DRF handicappers. Daily packs and longer plans for all budgets are available. Download full-card PPs for five of today's top tracks. Visit drf.com/multi-track today.
The thoroughbred breeding industry will never be the same with the launch of Daily Racing Form's Buyer-Sire Performance Standings, presented by Darley. These groundbreaking ratings use buyer speed figures to measure a stallion's performance beyond wins and earnings, focusing on providing a measurement of a sire's true ability to produce high-quality horses. View the Buyer-Sire Performance Standings at drf.com/buyer-sire and get the true information that breeds results. That's drf.com/buyer-sire.
Pennsylvania's breeding program is truly the most lucrative in North America. Now, we'll pay a 50% breeder award for PA-sired, PA-bred maidens who run first, second, or third, with 25% for non-PA-sired, PA-breds. Last year, the number of mares bred rose by 15% in Pennsylvania. And unlike some other states, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support Pennsylvania breeding and racing. This is Brian Sanfratello. Please visit us at PABred.com.
Hi, John Pirana here, inviting you to join me in the Dublin Racing Club, along with friends like Steve Bick and Tom Durkin. If you have an interest in Ireland and horse racing, it's the best way to be involved with both. So log on now to DublinRacingClub.com and come join us at one of Ireland's 26 racetracks.
The Dublin Racing Club is designed to introduce racing fans to the ownership experience by participating in the sport in Ireland. For more information on the Dublin Racing Club, log on to DublinRacingClub.com.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.